Coming up on Philosophy Talk, philosophy for children.
How do children think of the mind?
Your mind is that little voice inside of your head that tells you what to do and what not to do.
Do children think the mind is just the brain?
I think the brain has something that the mind doesn't do, or the mind has something that the brain doesn't do.
Do children know the difference between pleasure and happiness?
You could be happy inside, and then you could be sad all the way outside.
If a philosopher is talking to fourth graders and no one is listening, has he really said anything?
There's questioning everything anyway.
Our guest is Jana Moore Lone from the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children.
Whether we're going to engage them in thinking together about it or not is really the issue.
Philosophy for and with children.
Recorded in front of a live audience of fourth grade philosophers at the University of Washington in Seattle. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is a special edition of the program, coming to you from the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, everyone. Our topic today, appropriate to our venue, is philosophy for children.
Ken, you can learn a lot from children. Mostly, you can learn how little patience you have.
Oh, John, come on. We've got an audience full of children here. Don't be such a grouch. We're here with a bunch of delightful children at a center where young people do philosophy. I know that we're going to learn a lot from them.
Didn't John Locke say that our mind is a blank slate when we were born? It seems like it would take years of writing profound truths on that blank slate before anything of philosophical interest would show up.
Oh, John, you're looking at things exactly the wrong way. Children have a natural curiosity that leads them naturally to ask and think about philosophical issues. You know, it's all the writing that we adults do on that blank slate that gets in their way. And by the time they get to us in college, we have to work hard to rekindle what's really a natural instinct, a natural interest. We have to get them back to the wisdom that they had when they were fourth graders, like these kids here.
Okay, Mr. Optimistic, give me an example of this alleged natural curiosity.
Well, there's this philosopher, Garrett Matthews. He thinks a lot about children and philosophy. He's got a good example. Well, so he tells this situation of young Tommy. He's 6 years old, so even younger than these students in our audience. Tommy says to his papa, "Papa, how can we be sure that everything is not a dream? How can we be sure of that?" His father thinks a while, and he admits, "Gosh, Tommy, I have no idea." Well, Tommy has an answer. He says, "Well, Dad, I don't think that everything's a dream, because in a dream, people wouldn't go around asking, 'Is this a dream?'" So right there, the kid not only asks Descartes' famous question, "Could this all be a dream?" but he gives an answer to that question.
Yeah, and you know, actually, it's a better answer than Descartes managed to come up with. That's pretty impressive. But, you know, should we really encourage this predilection for philosophy in children? I mean, shouldn't kids this age be kept busy cleaning their room and learning to obey and spell correctly? Why give them philosophy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder what these kids would think. Would they be better off cleaning their rooms than doing philosophy in class?
I don't think Hannah thinks so.
No, you know what? I don't think so myself. I think it's a great thing, and I know our guest, Jana Moore Lone, who's the founder and director of this lovely center, I know she thinks that children develop a philosophical self at about age 5, just as they develop a social self, a moral self, an intellectual self, and other facets of their personality. So it starts really young, and we ought to encourage that.
Well, you know, that's kind of an interesting idea. I guess when my kids were that age, and now when my grandkids were that age, I used to pose all kinds of philosophical questions for them. You know, how can you get across a room if first you have to go halfway and halfway to halfway and halfway to halfway to halfway to halfway to halfway?
Sounds like you'll never get there.
Yeah, that's the point. And then, you know, they would say, "Well, I guess if you can't get across a room, I can't very well empty the garbage, can
yeah,
I?"
Yeah, right.
So I didn't realize I was doing something important like developing their little philosophical selves. I just was making them laugh.
Yeah.
They found it funny to hear their father ask such weird questions. And come to think of it, they still do.
Yeah, right, right. Well, in a moment, we're going to bring Jana Moore-Lone out to join us so we can learn more about the philosophical selves of children. Then we'll turn to our live audience of beginning young philosophers, fourth grade philosophers, here in Seattle to join the conversation too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Angela Kilduff, talks to some university students who are studying philosophy for children. She files this report.
Karen Emmerman has wanted to be a college professor since high school. She's now a doctoral student at the University of Washington, and when she watched Jana Moore-Lone teach philosophy to fourth graders, what she saw really surprised her.
I'm just amazed at how similar the conversations are when you're talking to children who have not read the highly theoretical academic articles versus speaking with undergraduates who have. I thought there would be a radical difference in the way that issues are talked about, and there's actually very little difference at all.
The experience even led her to consider working with younger students.
The fourth graders that Jana was teaching the other day pick up on exactly the same kinds of issues. They ask very similar kinds of questions, like the exactly relevant, some not so relevant, which also happens at the undergrad level. And they're just like right there and ready to talk about it in this way, even though there's been no machinery in place for talking about it. And that's been really striking.
I asked Emmerman what questions she would use to teach philosophy to children.
Well, I actually think this question of justice is really effective because they're very interested in matters of justice. So even young kids, who gets that toy and why do they get that toy and how come you get to eat a larger cookie than I do and these sorts of things. So they're interested, it affects their experience of their day-to-day life. And so I think they want to pick up on it and talk about it a little bit, and it helps them manage in the world.
Jana Moore-Lone gave the same assignment to her undergraduate students. After writing an essay about it, they shared their answers with the class.
The question that I decided on is, what is death? And not only like what is death, but what happens after you die? Like, sure, the body is still there, but what happens to like the mind and the soul? And it's important because no matter what, children will encounter death, whether it's like a friend, family, a pet, or a plant. And I think developing a sense of what death is at an early age, they can cope with it better.
What makes something right or wrong? And the reason why I thought that was a really interesting or important thing to discuss is because for a lot of our lives, a lot of the information that we're told, we just take verbatim and, you know, accept that as the absolute truth. And for me growing up, you know, I was raised Catholic, and I began to question that a lot when I turned about 9 or 10, actually, and really started asking myself why I believe certain things. You know, where did this knowledge come from? Who told it? Who, you know, originated it? Is it valid? Is it true? And so I think it's really important for, you know, kids to really question where their knowledge comes from.
I wanted to pose a question to mostly 12 to 14 year olds because that's the age at which, well, at least for me and for a lot of people in America, kids are getting a cell phone or have access to a computer of some kind. And the question that I wanted to ask was, what are we losing when we adapt this new form of communication? In other words, what is bad about a text message or an email? And I think that it's stripping away the authenticity from human relationships.
These are big issues, just like the topics Jana Moore-Lone has discussed with her fourth graders. Karen Emmerman says these conversations have astounding potential.
It'll change the way they think forever, hopefully.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Angela Kilduff.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the University of Washington in Seattle.
And we're joined now by Jana Moore-Lone. She's the founder and director of the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children at the University of Washington Department of Philosophy. Jana, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Jana, briefly, what led to your interest in philosophy and children and the founding of the center?
It's hard for me to be brief on this subject, but I'll try. Basically, when I was a graduate student working on my dissertation in philosophy, my oldest son was 4 and started asking what I recognized as obviously philosophical questions. What is time? How can something have no end? What is infinity? What is fairness? Why should I be kind to my little brother, et cetera? and so I started having these conversations with him, kind of engaging with him, not trying to answer the questions in the way I think parents often do for their children, but just trying to talk to him about the questions he was raising. And I started then teaching a philosophy class in his kindergarten, and it went from there.
So you started teaching a philosophy class in the kindergarten?
Yeah, I talked his kindergarten teacher into letting me come in and do philosophy with the five-year-olds. And yeah.
So you've got this view that children develop what you call a philosophical self at about that age, about the age of five. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. Well, I think, you know, we talk a lot about children's intellectual selves, their social and emotional selves, the development of their physical selves. But I also think children have what I call a philosophical self. That is, this part of them, part of us, all of us, that wonders about these big abstract questions that haunt us, I think, as human beings. You know, why are we here? What's the meaning of life? Why do we die? Etc. And I think that that part of children often fails to develop because it doesn't get nurtured. No one talks to them about it.
Well, right, because the schools are mostly not about nurturing, asking kids to reflect on those questions. I mean, gosh, we hardly ask high school students to reflect on those questions. And you are in this revolutionary thing. You want five-year-olds and six-year-olds and fourth graders to reflect. Are you finding... I mean, we're going to hear from the kids in a bit, but are you finding success? Are you finding the schools welcoming? Are you finding the teachers thrilled by this? Or I might be a little intimidated if I was a teacher and the students were questioning everything, as we say.
Well, the thing is that there's questioning everything anyway. And, whether we're going to engage them in thinking together about it or not is really the issue. And I think, I mean, my experience is that teachers have been completely welcoming of this and really enjoy watching the students participate in a different kind of way in the classroom.
Do you ever get any resistance that, look, these deep questions, children should just accept what their parents or their priest or their minister says?
You know, it's interesting. Only once, and that was probably 14 years ago, I was doing a parent meeting at a Catholic school, mm-hmm. and I had a parent say to me, I don't want my child to learn to think for herself.
Ooh, and you know, bad parent.
We just sort of parted ways. I mean, there was really nothing else to say.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk coming to you from the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children at the University of Washington in Seattle. Our guest is the center's director, Jana Moore-Lone.
In our next segment, we're going to put some of Jana's work into action by posing some classic philosophical questions to our live audience of fourth grade students, all from the John Muir Elementary School.
Mind and body, personal identity, and happiness, as seen by the young. That's you guys, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're in Seattle discussing philosophy for children with children with our guest Jana Moore-Lone, founder and director of the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children here at the University of Washington.
Are you ever too young to ask questions about the mind and the body, personal identity, happiness? We'll find out from our live audience of fourth graders from John Muir Elementary School in just a bit.
So, John, what kind of questions do you find that really grip, philosophical questions you find really grip children?
It really varies depending on the age, depending on the group. But for example, last week I had a wonderful discussion with the group of fourth graders in room 17 who are here today about personal identity.
So set up the story for our listening
this
audience.
This is a story.
It's by Philip Cam, and it's based on the Ship of Theseus. The story is there's a robot, and bit by bit, the robot has all of his parts replaced, so that eventually none of his original parts are still there. And then the robot company, without the owner of the robot knowing, takes all the original parts and builds a new robot that has all the original parts of the first robot. And the two robots meet, and they have quite a screaming match about which one is the real Algernon, which is the robot's name.
So there's two of them.
So there's
two. One built by these parts from the other one gradually, bit by bit. And you take all the old parts, and you put them together, and you assemble a brand new robot, and you've now got two of them. You got lots of questioners.
Yeah.
Tell us your name. Just your first name.
My name is Saint. I think that the one that that was here first, but that got all his parts replaced, is the real one, because all it did was take it apart and build it back again and send it back with a new. Then he gave him another new robot.
Uh-huh. Suppose that the company never put together the second robot from the original part. Suppose I buy this robot and I take it in and I get one part replaced and they put that part in the shell. And then I take it in again and I get another part replaced and they put the second part in the shell. And gradually my robot, every part breaks down and gets replaced by a new part. Do I still have my robot? Do you think I still have my robot?
I'm Stephanie and I think that you still have the same robot. It's just new parts.
Right.
My name is Elise, and I don't think it's the same robot because it has different parts than it usually had.
So now, people tell me that human beings like me, we get our parts replaced just automatically every 7 years ago. We have all new cells and so forth. Are we really the same persons we used to be? What do you think?
My name is Hillary. I think the robot that you were talking about is still the same because when you replace the old parts with the new parts, they're the same parts, but it's just new.
Right, but now, okay, so in my little thought experiment, we call this a thought experiment, right, Janet? Mm-hmm. My little thought experiment, the first version I gave you, all the parts got replaced, and I still had a robot, and I said, oh, I got the same robot, but now we're going to do back to Dr. Janet's thought experiment. Somebody says, oh, look at all these parts, and they build the robot again. They build a second robot with all the original parts. Who thinks that might change things?
My name's Dree. I think it changes because there's a whole new set of things. But with the one that has the old parts, I think it's not the same thing as the original Aldron because it's got everything new and it's as if it was a new, brand new built piece with
so
old ones, though.
Dr. Janet wants to get in here.
So what is it then that you think makes the real Algernon the real Algernon?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Jordan knows.
Well, I don't think that any of the Algernons are the real Algernons, because the second one that got rebuilt with the same old parts, it's the old Algernon. But I think it's like not the same one as the old one. And then the one that the parts got replaced, I think that one isn't either. I just think that none of the Algernons are the real Algernon, because the one that got replaced, that one had like, it got replaced. And then the one that had the old parts, it was rebuilt, so I don't think either of the Algernons are real.
I think that,
Ken, you can see the history of philosophy being recreated among these children. You know, there are really two different problems, or two related problems. The ship of Theseus is a problem about the identity of things, not particularly about persons. Theseus was, at least according to legend, a king of Athens. According to Plutarch, philosophers debated about whether, if over time all the parts of a ship were replaced, it would still be the same ship.
Now, ordinarily, we would count it as the same. I take my computer. It's a bit of a limit. I mean, I've had to replace a lot of its parts already. Its hard drive twice, its logic board once. It's just been a mess. Now, if in time I have to replace them all, it would still be my computer. It would be the very computer that I bought. For example, I mean, to show that, it wouldn't be fair for Apple to void my warranty by saying, now that we've replaced all the parts, it's not the same computer that you bought the warranty on, so no, we won't fix it anymore.
So that's a pretty persuasive answer. It is the same, even if all the parts are replaced. But then much later, Thomas Hobbes added a twist. Suppose someone collected all the ship parts that Theseus replaced and built a ship out of them. Wouldn't it also be the same ship? Or consider your computer. If the first time you took it in, the repairman took it completely apart and then put it all back together with the same parts, that would be the same computer. So it seems that if someone collected all the parts as they were replaced and put them back together,
he would have a computer, and wouldn't it be your computer? But now suppose both things happen. Then we have two computers, or in the Theseus case, two ships. Which one is the original, or are they both the original?
Well, I tell you one thing. I'd want the computer built from the new parts, not the old. So I'd want the built one built from the new parts to be my computer. Now, philosophers, logicians, and common sense itself tells us the following thing. If A and B are identical, then that means there aren't two things, A and B. There's just one thing. That means if A is the same as B, and A is the same as C, then there's just one thing that is A, B, and C. There's just one thing, not three things there, because it's just one thing all along. But here we've got two ships and two computers. We wanted to say they're both my computer, but they can't be. Something's going wrong, John.
Philosophers have discussed this kind of problem for centuries, and we can see our young philosophers go over all the same alternatives and give reasons for each in the same way that philosophers have done. Let's go back to Seattle and our philosophical conversation with the fourth graders from John Muir Elementary.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children at the University of Washington in Seattle. Our guest is the center's director, Jana Moore-Lone.
So suppose Dr. Jana and I happened to be in the hospital for some brain work at the same time, and they got mixed up, and they got her brain in my head and my brain in her head.
Oh, poor Jana.
Well, so what should we say? Should we say, John Perry has become a young, pretty girl, and Dr. Jana has become an old, white-haired grump?
We call those women now, John.
Or should we say that, John Perry is still an old, white-haired guy. He has a lot of different thoughts than he used to. Which should we say, or neither?
Jaden, what do you think?
I think that if you have Dr. Jana's head in your body, then it will still be Dr. Jana, except you'll just go back to the hospital and try to change it.
That's a good practical answer, I think.
Is that Haley? Are you Haley? I can't
Ashley.
See. Ashley.
I think that if, what's your name?
Dr. Perry.
Dr. John.
If Dr. Perry had his brain in Dr. Jana's head, I think, like what you guys said, they would be the same person because nothing's changed with their face or their body or anything. They would just have different thoughts.
John's going to come home to his wife, Frenchie, right? This body with that brain is going to come home to his wife, Frenchie, and Frenchie's going to say, so how did the show go with the fourth graders? And
what will I say?
What will you say? You say, well, the host asked the strangest questions. And Frenchie will say, well, what do you mean the host asked the strangest questions? You're the host. He said, no, I'm not the host, because she doesn't remember being the host. She's the guest, and her brain remembers being the guest. So what will happen there? Will Frenchie say, oh, that's my same husband with different
hosts? No, she's the one that'll take me back to the hospital. Yeah. Or she might not.
Lots of questions there. Tell us your name.
My name is Marie, and I think that you guys are both different persons because you have a different person. Dr. Jana would have a different personality, and Dr. Perry would have a different personality, but you just have the same body, but you would actually be a different person.
So we got some more questions. Go ahead, Dr. Jana.
So we'd be a different person because, if I have Dr. Perry's head, wouldn't I have Dr. Perry's personality?
Yeah.
But you don't think I would be Dr. Perry?
Well, you wouldn't be Dr. Jana, but you would have Dr. Perry's personality, like what he likes and stuff.
Did you want to say something, Hillary?
I think that you two are kind of the same.
So, John, at this point, we've gotten off to a rather different version of the ship of Theseus. We've got a person involved. So that means we've got consciousness and memory involved, and that changes things.
And we're not talking about replacing all of the parts, but just a key part, the brain, which seems to be responsible for consciousness and memory.
Now, if you donated your heart or your kidney to Dr. Jana, no one doubts that she would continue to be her. She would still be Dr. Jana. But the brain, now that seems to raise different questions.
We see the children defending each possible answer, just as philosophers have done. It could be Dr. Jana with different thoughts and memories. It could be me with a new body, or maybe it's neither of us.
But let's go back. Let's reduplicate our Ship of Theseus case. Now, suppose that we made an exact duplicate of your brain before we gave it to Dr. Jana, and then we put the duplicate back in you. both people would have a pretty strong case for being you. They'd have the same memories, the same desires. But just like the ship of Theseus, they can't both be you.
You know, that problem's been discussed a lot by contemporary philosophers, but it really goes back to the 18th century in a debate between Anthony Collins, Samuel Clarke, about Locke's theory of personal identity. By the way, I edited an anthology called Personal Identity that contains most of the important historical pieces on this problem. You can get it from the University of California Press.
Consideration of the brain and personal identity led our young philosophers into one of the hottest topics in philosophy, the relation between mind and body.
Well, my name's Ella, and I think that your mind is that little voice inside of your head that tells you what to do and what not to do and what you should say. And when you're just sitting there thinking, that's the little voice that is talking to you.
That sounds good. But Ella, what do you think your brain is? Is your brain the same thing or something different from that?
I don't think your brain is the same thing. I think your brain is what holds, like, what tells your body to move and what tells you to, like, see and talk and stuff.
So, some more thoughts about mind and body.
My name's Asiana, and I think that I kind of agree with Ella. Like, your mind is a little voice that tells you what to do in your head. Like, if you want to go and, like, eat something you're not supposed to eat, but then it tells you to do it anyway. It's your mind that's
telling
you.
That's called the devil.
Yeah, okay.
So remember we asked this question yesterday, if you took out your brain, could you see your mind? Do you think that it is something you could see?
Hannah.
My name is Hannah. I think you can't see it because it's in your head and you can't really see your head. You can only see it if you're looking in a mirror, but you can't see like inside of your head. So you can't.
But what if Dr. Perry and I did the brain transplant, and while we were doing it, you could look at my brain? Would you be able to point to my mind?
Well, I don't think you can, because maybe some people can't see it, and they might look for it, but they might not be able to find it.
My name's Swansett, and I think that your mind is kind of just all your brain put together, and it's like maybe just like a level up, like kind of controls your brain, and your brain just tells your body to move your mouth or your hands or your whatever. But I don't think you can see your mind because.
What was your name again?
Swansett.
Swansett. So if I took your brain out of your body and showed it to you, or if I took Dr. Perry's brain out of his body and showed it to you, you'd be seeing his brain, right?
Yeah.
Would you be seeing his mind?
No.
Because the mind and the brain are just two different things altogether?
Yeah, they're two different things.
So would it make sense for something that didn't have a brain to have a mind? I mean, like, could we find out that this table had a mind, and it just, since it didn't have a mouth, it couldn't tell us about anything?
Well, that's a really good question.
I don't think a table would have a mind.
Why not? Why wouldn't a table have a mind?
I don't really, because it can't move on its own. We're reading this book in class called Edward Tulane, and he has like a mind of his own. He can't move himself, but he thinks inside himself.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing philosophy for children with Jana Morlone, founder of the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children here at the University of Washington, with an audience full of fourth graders, eager and wise fourth graders. And we're going to get to more questions from you now. Okay, so we were talking about mind and brain. Does anybody think that the mind and the brain are just the same thing? That they're just, anybody believe that? Mm-hmm. Do you believe that? The mind and the brain are just the same thing?
I'm Jerry again. I don't think the mind and the brain are the same exact thing, because I think the brain has something that the mind doesn't do, or the mind has something that the brain doesn't do. And the reason I think that is the mind thinks a lot about what kind of things you have a choice of. Like, if you have a choice of eating something really not good for your body or something really healthy for your body. But your brain moves, like, your mind chooses what the choice you choose, and then your brain does, moves your body to do it.
So the brain is just like the implementer, like the second in command. Your mind tells your brain what to do, and then your brain tells your body what to do. We've got this young man in the front row. We haven't had a male voice here. What's your name?
I'm Bryce.
Hi, Bryce. What do you want to say?
I think that they're not the same thing because maybe the mind does like the first command, like what Dree said, but maybe it can also tell what your body to do and your brain also.
So your mind, your body is kind of like your own personal robot, and you control it from inside because you are really your mind. That's your picture.
I want to ask you all a question, though. What happens to your mind if your brain like has a hemorrhage and your brain stops functioning? You think your mind can go on when your brain's not working anymore? Over here, Elise?
I don't think that your mind would keep working because your brain like makes your mind work, I think.
Your brain makes your mind work. That's a really nice thought. So your mind might be separate from your brain, but it can't work without your brain, and your brain doing something is what makes your mind possible. That's really a good thought. There's back there.
I'm Elaine, and if your brain tells you what to do and move, but your mind tells you what to say.
Well, on that note, that we're going to come back, and we're going to get more from our live audience of eager and wise fourth graders, but right now I'll remind you that you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing philosophy for children with Jana Morlone, director of the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children.
How do children think about happiness? That's what we'll consider when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're in Seattle discussing philosophy for children with Jana Morlone. So, you know, this is an amazing conversation we just had with these kids. And we're going to get some more. But look, I mean, when we were talking about personal identity, they were everywhere that philosophers are, and for many of the same reasons. They weren't quite as articulate as you find in the tomes of academic philosophy, but they were citing the same kind of reasons. And on the mind-body thing, it's the same thing.
We often say that they recreate the history of philosophy in the discussions we have without all of the history and texts.
And if anybody doubted that there was a sort of a natural inborn dualism, should listen to that last segment.
Well, but there was also emergentism. I love the girl who said, well, the brain makes your mind work. I mean, the mind is different from the brain, but without the brain, the mind couldn't happen because the brain makes... That's like emergentism, you know? And that's the classic and deep thing in philosophy. So I was really impressed.
So now we're going to ask him about happiness, but what are the kind of the main positions on happiness? Just remind me before we start. I don't want to fall behind the children too much.
Well, the discussion we had a few weeks ago really centered around whether happiness is a feeling. You know, we talk about feeling happy, and often when we think about happiness, we equate it with pleasure, and that was how the conversation began, because we talked about whether going to the dentist's office is important for happiness. And then we started to talk about whether happiness really was a feeling or was something more than that.
Yeah, so why don't we get into that? So how would you help bring them in? Did you have a setup that you cue our listening audience into?
Yes, what we did was I gave them a list of things and asked them which things were most important for their happiness from 1 to 8. And maybe some of you can talk about what was important for your happiness and why. Let's have somebody who...
Let's get some kids in the back.
Well, right there, where the teacher is.
What's important for our happiness? Dentist chair got 8, which was the worst. Playing with a friend got 1, and 2 was eating your favorite food.
So if you never went to the dentist, though, and your teeth were to fall out, and, you know, you had all gums, and you couldn't eat your favorite food anymore, would that be a good thing?
Well, since crab's my favorite food, it's like not that hard. It's like
we got more questions.
My name's Ayana, and when we were talking about this in class, I thought that happiness was something that you need and something that you get from nature.
Happiness you get from nature? How do you get it from nature?
I'm sick from nature, but I like playing with flowers, gardening, and stuff like that. It makes me happy, and also with things I need, like going to the dentist and having to eat food and things so your body can work.
Right, so as I recall, Ayana, you were saying that happiness is kind of like a state of your body being in good health or something like that, right? Let's see, who haven't we heard from?
My name's Drew, and I think happiness is something like you could choose, like you could choose whether or not you want to be happy, like if you could choose if you want your life to be happy or if you want to be mad. Or
Do you guys think that someone can be wrong about how happy they are? I mean, suppose you had a kid that, you know, had everything. They had the nicest food and the nicest house and the nicest, video games. So they had what everybody else wants, but then you ask them and they said, well, I'm very unhappy because, you know, I only have two dogs and I want to have three dogs. Could they just be wrong? Could you say, well, you're really very happy, you just don't know it?
Elise?
There are lots of...
Well, you could be happy inside, and then you could be sad all the way outside.
What do you mean by that, Elise? Give me an example of what
like,
you mean.
If I were really happy because I won a prize, but then really sad that everybody else lost.
Oh. So you could be happy about one thing and sad about something else. And if you're really happy about one thing but sad about something else, what would you say? Are you happy, all things considered? I mean, if you weigh it all up, are you happy or are you mostly sad or what?
You're like in the middle.
Jaden?
I think my most happy place is really the dentist because I get away from school for a little bit. and that when they do stuff on me, they like... say it's not gonna hurt or something, and they just check my teeth, and then that's my like my favorite place to be.
The comments you've been making all sound like you think happiness is a feeling, then, like feeling pleasure, right? Is that what happiness is, do you think, or do you think it might be something different other than that?
It's me again, Dree. I don't think happiness is a feeling or something that just I think it sort of just happens gradually as you have something happy to you. Like it seems like things are happy when you think it is, but I think most of the time when something is happy is after you have had what you need. As in like sometimes you're all alone and you're sad, so you need something or someone to play with you. So you kind of have someone to do something with. And then like when your teeth are all like rotten and stuff, you need someone or something to help you. Mm-hmm. So you go to the dentist and the dentist cleans your teeth and helps them. So, and then that's when you become happy.
You know, Ken, one thing that philosophy shows us is that the things we think are most important are often the things we seem to know the least about. And the things that make us most confused when we try to think about them.
I hear you there, John. I mean, for example, St. Augustine said that he knew what time was until he started thinking about it. Everyone wants to be free. Everyone thinks they're free. But philosophers have fought for two millennia about what that amounts to. Everyone wants to be happy. But philosophers have as much trouble as children saying what that is, although they do so at greater length, that's for sure.
If it's a feeling, then it seems like we'd have to know if we're happy or not. If it's some kind of complicated condition, like thriving or living a life that's meaningful, then we might be happy without knowing it.
And then there is the connection between happiness and morality. If something makes you happy, can it be wrong? But what if your happiness depends on someone else's unhappiness?
Let's go back to Seattle and our philosophical conversation with fourth graders from John Muir Elementary.
My name is Ella, and I think
Like, sitting in the dentist chair is important because, say, I had maybe cancer and I was in the hospital getting chemotherapy or whatever, and I hated it a lot. But
don't blame you.
When I got out, I was happy and I didn't have cancer anymore. And I think happiness isn't, like, it's not always a feeling. I think it's sometimes, I don't know, but I don't think it's always a feeling.
Let me ask you another kind of question about happiness. So Ella said, told us a story in which somebody had chemotherapy and got out and got cured and they were really happy. And that seems like a really good thing to be happy about. A really good thing to be happy about. And, you know, if you weren't happy about that, that'd be a little strange. But some people are happy, say, when other people get hurt. Mm-hmm. Is it all right to be happy when somebody else gets hurt or when somebody else loses something or gets beat up? Or what do you think about that?
Let's get in the back on the right there. Young lady's had her hand up quite a bit and hasn't been called on.
My name is Marie, and I think I wouldn't be happy because, you know, like, what happens if you fell down and you break your own skull and someone else laughs at you? That wouldn't really be...
Yeah, you wouldn't like that yourself.
You wouldn't like it. It's like if someone gets beat up and you laugh at it, then another person comes up and beats you up, and then that same person laughs at you. It wouldn't really be that.
But what about if you were the kind of person who both felt happy when other people got hurt and didn't mind when you got hurt? You just sort of didn't really enjoy living very much, and you were happy when anyone got hurt. Would that be an okay thing, do you think? Would we say that person really is happy, or would we say something other than that?
Jordan, okay. Why don't we come up? Okay, we got one, and then Jordan over
I
here.
I think, okay. No, you wouldn't be happy, because if that was you, you wouldn't be so happy either. Like, I would feel sorry for them that happened to them, but instead of feeling happy and stuff and, like, laughing at them, so I would feel sad.
What I'm trying to figure out, are there some things it's right to be happy about, and there's something it's wrong to be happy about, or just whatever makes you happy, right? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Some things it's wrong to be happy about. You say, oh, you're happy about my misfortune. Shame on you. You shouldn't be happy about my misfortune. What do you think, Jordan?
I think, well, like you said, if you're happy when people get hurt and you don't really care when you get hurt, I think that, like, deep down inside you, you would be sad that you got hurt and you would be sad for other people, but you want to act happy because, like, when you get hurt, you don't want to be all sad. Because you want to show that you're happy that you got hurt somehow, to show that you're, like, brave. But I think you're right to be sad that someone else gets hurt, or you're right to be sad that you get hurt.
So here's a thought. So happiness may just be a feeling. I don't know if it's just a feeling. But it's also something we think it can be good or bad in different circumstances. So that seems like it's more than a feeling. I mean, because it's got what we call a moral component, right?
Right, like, are there some things that it's not okay to feel happy about?
Well, say if somebody fell down and you were, like, having a really good day, you could still feel happy for yourself, but you would feel sad for the person. Like, you wouldn't be happy. Well, you'd be still be happy because what if that was you and you, like, broke your skull, and you would be happy that didn't happen to you. So that's okay to be happy about, but like, you're kind of always happy because, and well, you never like really truly unhappy, because there's always good things in love. Say that you're like homeless, you didn't have any money, and so, but you could still be happy because you're still alive.
You know what, guys? They're giving me the signal. You have there's so many more questions that you have, and so many more hands, and I hate to end this, but radio is a finite thing. So. Jana, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really eye-opening conversation. These kids are amazing.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you to all the students for coming and participating in the conversation. It's been really fun.
Our guest has been Jana Morlone. She's the founder and director of the Northwest Center for Philosophy for Children at the University of Washington and the Department of Philosophy, and they're doing amazing work.
And we also want to thank everyone in our live audience, both the kids and their teachers and everyone else that's here, but particularly our young friends from John Muir Elementary here in Seattle for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, what are your closing thoughts? This has been an amazing experience, I think.
Well, I don't know. I'm kind of humbled because, you know, I teach freshmen in college introductory philosophy, and I think I'm doing such a great job getting them to ask all these basic questions and come up with some interesting thoughts. And it turns out they could have done it on their own in the fourth grade, or maybe not on their own, but with a little help from someone. But like Jan alone.
Well, obviously we're doing something wrong because these kids were from all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of ethnicities, all sorts gender mix, everything, and it was really cool. And but I'll say that this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we turn to the fast-talking kid in all of us, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, these days parents actively seek to discover and develop superior qualities in their children. They play Mozart for them as the children sleep in their ergonomically designed cribs. Lest we forget, Mozart was himself a gifted child. Parents play Genius Babies DVDs. They stimulate infants by any means available. You can't start young enough. I read on one website, every healthy baby is a born genius. Well, that seems unlikely to me. How would you tell the intricate pattern of the drool? When I was a kid in the 1950s, too much intelligence was mistrusted. Too smart for your own good, I'd hear. Too clever by half. Don't outsmart yourself. It's not rocket science. It's not brain surgery. Nobody likes a smart aleck. I think it was a fear of intellectualism trickled down to middle America. Darwin, we're all secret monkeys. Freud, we're all ruled by inner demons we will never understand. Einstein, he explained the universe, and now bombs can destroy the universe. Two world wars, the Depression, despite the efforts of big brains, maybe even because of them. Our parents didn't want gifted children. They just hoped we'd be normal. I did discover one day that I could put pencils up my nose. My friends thought I was a genius, but that opinion did not last, and it was not shared by my parents. Today, however, children must be gifted. The alternative is too horrible. Helicopter parenting has become a term. Helicopter parents hover. They never leave their children alone. Thanks to the cell phone, they can be in constant contact with their children. They help with tests. Some parents even take the tests for their children. Childhood today has benchmarks, just like the federal budget. If those benchmarks are missed, children are doomed. I'm reminded of John Stuart Mill, the 19th century British philosopher, the oldest of nine children. He was aggressively homeschooled by his father, James Mill, later described by his son as a grim and exacting man. Young John read Latin and Greek by the time he was eight, studied algebra, did not play with other children. The goal was to turn John Stuart Mill into a perfect analytical thinking machine so he would enable his father's vision of an ideal society based on utilitarian principles, the greatest good for the greatest number. Then when John Stuart Mill turned 21, he had a breakdown. In his autobiography, he explained, suppose that all your objects in life were realized, that all the changes in institutions and opinions which you're looking forward to could be completely affected this very instant, would this be a great joy and happiness to you? And an irrepressible self-consciousness distinctly answered, no. He started reading poetry. His father distrusted poetry, fell in love, discovered his own way, and eventually found a measure of happiness. The message is, well, there's probably some middle ground between micromanaging your children and ignoring them. And if they want to stick weird objects up their nose, by all means, praise them for being clever, but make it very, very clear, this will never make them any money. Believe me, I've been there. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Andrew Smith, Sarah Goring, and the University of Washington Department of Philosophy.
Thanks also to Brian Moynihan, Ryan Hirsch, Angela Kilduff, Izzy White, and Merle Kessler.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich, the incomparable Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research, and Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable, they don't. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And that's a wrap.